Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. Bienvenidos, bienveni, bienvenido. This morning, at a press conference in Miami Gardens, eight-term South Florida Democratic Congresswoman Frederica Wilson confirmed that she will not seek re-election in November.
The Congresswoman is not going to seek another term. Even leather wears out.
The 83-year-old Wilson's exit leaves her district, Florida's 24th, a Democratic stronghold that includes North Miami-Dade and South Broward counties, open for a new generation of challengers. A likely frontrunner is expected to be Democratic State Senator Chevron Jones, who just announced he won't seek re-election to the state legislature. I spoke with Jones yesterday, that is Thursday, about his possible congressional candidacy, and about the complicated chessboard South Florida Democrats face now that Florida's new congressional map has cut their number of blue seats in half. Among the disputes, Democratic Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz's decision this week to run in the 20th district, one historically reserved for a black representative. Senator Jones, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Tim.
You've announced that you're ending your reelection campaign for the Florida State Senate, and you're hinting that, quote, another chapter may just be beginning. What led you to this decision not to run again for the state legislature, but are you preparing to run for Congress in the state's 24th district?
You know, Tim, I have spent the last 13 years in the legislature, of course, 8 years in the House and 6 years in the Florida Senate, which has been an absolute pleasure championing the work that I have championed over these last few years. Me resigning at this point in time was to give an opportunity for somebody else to continue the work that we have started in Tallahassee, and someone who will continue the work in this district, which is the largest black district in the state of Florida. There are other opportunities that potentially might open up. Whether that happen or not, that is not what I will just wait in the wing on, because there are other things I can do. That we do know that the Congresswoman currently now, there's speculation that the Congresswoman is going to retire. I do not know the Congresswoman's timeline of when that's going to happen.
Meaning, I should say, meaning Frederica Wilson.
That's right, Congresswoman Wilson. I'm not sure of her timeline, but if and when that time comes, is that something that I would look at? Absolutely, I will absolutely take a look at that. Tim, I'll be honest, I've always said that I will go as far as the people will take me. And if it makes sense and the people believe it's the best move, then that's something that I will do.
Now, you've said you would support Congresswoman Frederica Wilson if she seeks another term for her 24th district seat. She's 83 years old. At the same time, many Democrats appear to be looking toward the future of leadership in South Florida. So what conversations do you think the community is having right now about generational change?
Yeah, listen, I think there is a balance that needs to happen. I think we need to look at what it means to have steady handed leadership, which I also call seasoned leadership. And also believe that there's a time to where we also need to bring in new leadership. I think this balance is necessary. The seasoned generation mentoring the younger generation that's coming into Congress or coming into anybody is extremely important. I think the conversation that's happening in the community is people are looking for what does bold leadership look like. They are looking for what does it look like for us to move into this next era. Not just politics, but this new normal that has been created because of this administration and previous administrations and what they have created. I think people are looking for bold leadership in this moment, but I do think there needs to still be a balance, because it just makes for a better institution.
But if you do pursue Florida's 24th congressional district seat, why would you argue you represent that bold leadership, as you just put it? Why would you argue you're qualified to replace a popular veteran lawmaker in Washington like Frederica Wilson at this moment in your career?
You look at people who have held this seat, like Carrie Meek. You look at people who have held who holds this seat now, Frederica Wilson. These individuals they have never been afraid to stand up to big fights in Tallahassee. For the past 13 years, I have stood up to big fights, whether it was after the death of George Floyd, and the governor making it illegal to protest in streets, and to and for people to speak up. I don't mind going toe to toe with individuals. I don't mind going toe to toe with bullies, especially when it comes to people who I represent, people who I love. And that is that there will be no different in this fight. You look what's happening in Washington, D.C. right now. We've been fighting Donald Trump, and we've been fighting what we're seeing right now in Washington, D.C. from Tallahassee, because we know that that is the impetus for all of this is happening. And I can continue that strong fight in Washington.
Now, you've built a reputation in Tallahassee as a vocal advocate on voting rights, education, and health care, despite serving in a very Republican-controlled legislature. How would your approach change or stay the same if you were elected to Congress?
How I have functioned in Tallahassee has worked. And that has been gaining the trust of my colleagues on the other side of the aisle. So they know that my fight for my community trumps everything. The fight for the people who I represent trumps everything. And our friendship will never be that strong to where I don't push back on anyone who is beating up on the little man or the little woman. And so I will continue that, but I will work across the aisles. I will continue to do that. And that's why I have been successful in the Florida legislature. And that has been because gaining the trust of my colleagues to know that, yeah, Chevron means business when he's fighting for the people within his district and people within the state of
Now,
Florida.
you've also mentioned concerns about rising costs and housing affordability. South Florida remains one of the most expensive places to live in this country. What specific federal policies do you believe are needed to address that crisis in localities like this one?
First of all, we have to look at what the relationship that our state has with the federal government and how those dollars are being dispersed into communities. Being able to push back currently right now on this administration on the wasteful spending, and not only just in this way in their wasteful spending, but what we are ignoring when we are spending billions of dollars on wars, pushing back on and how we what we're doing to our education system and those dollars that are not transferring to our state, that's not going to our communities. I mean, we have to continue to work with Leader Jeffries. We'll continue to work with my Democratic colleagues in each state to make sure that we are collaborating on what it means to bring relief and affordability to the state,
Right.
to our state and to our community.
Congressman Jeffries being the minority leader in the House of
That's correct.
Representatives. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Democratic State Senator Chevron Jones about his decision not to run for re-election and his possible decision to run instead for Congress in Florida's 24th district, as well as the new district chessboard South Florida Democrats now face. Now, you've been critical of U.S. Representative Debbie Wasserman Schultz of South Florida, who currently represents Florida's 25th congressional district, for her recent decision to run in District 20, which is a historically black district in Broward County. Why do you feel she's wrong to do this?
No, I don't want to use that type of language as far as her being wrong, because this is a democracy. So people have the right to do whatever they desire to do. And Debbie and I have been friends for a very long time. I will be very frank that she has done a lot for this community and she has done a lot for the party. With that being said, there is also an aura that is going across this country that we see with the elimination of black representation in this in the country. And that coupled with what we just saw in Tallahassee, where the governor has taken it has take it has condensed the amount of black access seats that we have. And it's just so by happen that Debbie has is now running in a traditionally black held seat that Alcee Hastings used to
Right.
hold. That is a historic district. It's not the fact that she's wrong for doing it. It's the fact that we're pushing back on the elimination of black representation down to one black access seat in a state of 24 million people. Everyone, and I'll say this, as I always have said, everyone deserves to have a seat at the table. Every race, every group, it doesn't matter what color, everyone deserves to have a seat at the table. Why? Because people should be represented by people who know their lived experience.
But you are asking her to reconsider this decision?
Yes. I mean, if not just ask them to reconsider, it's also ask to sit down and talk with, and I think that's going that's happening. But it's also asking to sit down and talk with the Black community and those individuals with those concerns, so she know and she have that relationship. Because listen, if she stays in and she wins, that those are relationships that she still will have to have, and she at least have established a some type of baseline of conversation that has started, and they need to have the tough conversation.
Now, you are also endorsing David Jolly for governor when there's a Black candidate, Jerry Demings, running against him. Can you explain why Jolly then is getting your support?
You know, I had my support with Mr. Jolly prior to Mr. Demings jumping in the race. I held off on the endorsement out of respect for our respect for Mr. Demings. I did reach out to Mr. Demings after I spoke with after session and let him know that my endorsement for Mr. Jolly was coming out. And listen, David made a good case to me, and but not only did he make a good case, David also he showed me that he has a winning strategy and what it means to not just go after Democrats, but also being able to win over the independents and Republicans, because he has a message that I believe personally that we need right now to bring individuals from both sides and get back on track to governance. Because we've seen what has been happening in the last 8 years, and I think David, he has what it takes to get us back on track, not for just from a Democratic Party standpoint, but collectively as a state.
Now, your Democratic colleague, Congressman Jared Moskowitz, announced this week that he's running for election, re-election in the newly drawn District 25, which is now a Republican stronghold. Will you support him? How do you think he'll do?
Absolutely. Jared is one of my closest friends, and Jared is probably one of the best orators that we have in the Democratic Party. I think that Jared is going to do well. Jared he resonates with both sides of the aisle. Jared is with you when he's right, but he rolls deep with the party, with his party, and he believes in his democratic values. He's as you he's a strong advocate for his Jewish community, for Israel, and so which is the large part of that district. So Jared will know how to communicate with those people, and I predict Jared will be going back to Congress.
Now, if you were to run for Congress and if you were elected, you would become Florida's first openly LGBTQ member of Congress. What significance would that have for you personally and for representation from this state?
I think I've said this on this show before, and that is, if you don't have if you're not at the table, then you're on the menu.
Right.
Listen, representation is important, but much bigger than being the first of anything. It's important that other young Black men, it's important that other LGBTQ plus individuals, they see someone who they can see themselves in, and it's a privilege to be able to do that. I'm not in it for that. I genuinely mean this, Tim, that I desire to leave this place much better than it was than when I was born on October 12th, 1983. And I think this is the path that individuals can look at and say that he did that. In the same way that I look at other people to say he or she did that, and they made this path for us, I think it's important.
1983, that makes me feel old. Democrats in Florida have struggled statewide in recent election cycles. As someone who led the Miami-Dade Democratic Party ahead of the 2024 elections, what do you believe the party needs to do differently to reconnect with voters on the local, state, and national levels?
Listen, first of all, shout out to Laura Kelly, the chair for the Miami-Dade Democrats. Like, she is doing an amazing job with organizing in Miami-Dade County. She's doing an amazing job in re-engaging people from all various different communities. I think the Democrats in Florida are on a high. I don't think that we're that special that the family fights that we might see that might be happening are foreign to us. But I think Nikki is creating a strong coalition around the state, and I know that there are people who the feelings are scattered of what their thoughts are as far as leadership is concerned. That's a conversation that we can have after November. But I've spoken with Nikki almost once a week. I think the party is doing the best they can right now. I think they're riding the wave that we see that's happening across the country. I think we're riding the wave of Eileen Higgins. I think we're riding the wave of Emily Gregory. I think we're riding the wave of Brian Nathan. I mean, there's so many other wins that's happening. I think we have to keep that momentum. Last thing I'll say is that engaging in the messaging that must be maintained right now is letting know that the Republicans have not made our lives better. You have a president of the United States who came in and said that he wanted to lower costs, but we have the highest gas prices. Inflation hasn't gone down. I mean, so we have to make it clear that we're living in a time where the Republicans have not made our lives better, but and that's why they're doing what they're doing now with the
Right.
elimination of seats and all these things that we're seeing.
Now, and Eileen Higgins, Emily Gregory, Brian Nathan, I should mention those are names of Democrats who were recently elected in Florida, right?
Yes, right.
Now, you said your decision came after, quote, prayer, reflection, and honest conversation. At this point in your public life, Senator Jones, what do you believe your constituents are asking from their leaders that they just may not be getting right now?
You know, that's an when I last week I had my I had an event, the Truth event that talked about voting rights and the new maps. A young lady said something that resonated with me. She said, "All we're doing is looking for politicians to tell the truth." She said, "We don't believe you all because you say what you say, but when you get elected, we never see you again." Yeah, I think people are looking for less politicians and they're looking for more human beings. Like, let your I don't know be your I don't know. Let your I'm going to do this be your I'm going to do it. And I think that's what people are looking for. And then they truly want to see people who are fighting like hell on their behalf. I think people want it now. I don't think they just want to hear you say it. I think people want to see it. Even if you, I mean, I've been a minority party for quite some time. And yes, I haven't been successful in a lot of things that I would desire to do. But if people can see that you're at least fighting, then I think that's what people are seeing. Like, don't go down without a fight. Show that you at least are fighting. I think people want to see that.
Senator Jones, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tim.
That was my conversation yesterday, Thursday, with Democratic State Senator Chevron Jones. After Congresswoman Frederica Wilson's announcement this morning that she will not seek re-election, Jones is now expected to announce his candidacy for her 24th district seat next week. Still to come, a lighter hurricane season forecast, but what about that El Nino? This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. Our six-month Atlantic hurricane season starts on Monday, June 1st. Forecasters are predicting a lighter storm season, which is, of course, great news. But then again, all it takes is one bad hurricane, one Andrew, to turn a light season into a historic disaster. And what about that unusually strong El Nino pattern everybody keeps talking about? Is that good or bad news? And either way, after the hundreds of Trump administration layoffs we've seen in the past year and a half at agencies like the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, do we have the necessary core of expert forecasters in place to warn us about what may still develop out there? The good news there is that many of those displaced weather experts have been picked up at the University of Miami, so they're still out there keeping an eye on things. But that and the lighter hurricane forecast doesn't mean, of course, that we can be complacent. Far from it. How are you preparing for what may be a less angst-ridden hurricane summer? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now in the studio is WLRN's environment editor, Jenny Stiletovich. Jenny, how are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Also with us is Ben Kurtman. He's a professor of atmospheric science and dean of the University of Miami's Rosenstiel School of Marine, Atmospheric, and Earth Science. Professor Kurtman, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me here today.
Jenny Stiletovich, as I mentioned, forecasters, meaning NOAA, are predicting a relatively quiet hurricane season that starts on Monday. As you've pointed out, it's the first time they've called a slower season in more than a decade. What do they foresee, and what are they basing it on?
So they are calling for between 8 and 14 named storms, 3 to 6 hurricanes, and 1 to 3 major hurricanes. Those numbers fall anywhere from average to below average seasons, but they're saying it'll be below average because of this El Nino that, mm-hmm. that everybody's talking about.
And the El Nino is supposedly supposed to do what to keep things
right.
below average?
Yeah. So El Ninos can deliver strong atmospheric winds over here. They form mm-hmm. in the Pacific, but over here they can create wind shear, which is basically crosswinds that can kind of lop off the top of a hurricane
right.
or
uh-huh.
change the shape of it, tilt it on its side so it can't form.
Yeah, I've often heard, weather experts have also often told me, particularly the Hurricane Center here, that the Atlantic is actually a place where hurricanes go to die because of that frequent phenomenon of them having, of, you know, cutting the storm's heads off. Is that an accurate way of looking at it?
When there's an El Nino,
okay,
yeah.
When there's an El Nino.
But I would say if there's no El Nino, they don't die.
Okay. And again, repeat the number of named storms that we can expect.
8 to 14 named storms, which fits in the range of normal, but they're giving it a better chance of being below average.
I think they've been saying like flip a coin, 50-50, right?
Yeah, 55% chance. Okay. So there's a lot of uncertainty when they say below normal.
Okay. Ben Kirtman, I'd like to go into more detail with you about that, quote, super El Nino factor that we're seeing this year. Lay people like me hear about El Nino and La Nina all the time, but about all we really know about them is that they have something to do with Peruvian fishermen and what they see at Christmas time. Can you explain to us what those two weather patterns are and elaborate on what Jenny just mentioned about El Nino's outsized influence on this year's hurricane season?
Okay, that's a whopper of a question. How much time do you got? What El Nino and La Nina are a phenomenon that is primarily focused in the tropical Pacific. The way to think about it is we go through these cycles where the tropical Pacific, the eastern Pacific in particular, is warmer than normal, say 4 degrees, 6 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than normal, and periods of time when it's a lot less than normal, say 4 to 6 degrees below normal. So there's these cycles, and they happen every, you know,
right.
2 to 7 years.
But the El Nino happens when it's at the warmer stage.
In the warmer phase.
Right.
And that disrupts, what happens is that shifts where it rains in the tropics, and that ultimately that shifts weather patterns around the globe. And so what Jenny was referring to is that El Nino effect, although it's primarily in the Pacific, it does shift wind patterns around the world, so it increases that shear in the Atlantic that sort of prevents those storms from forming vertically upright.
Okay.
It has another effect on the storms in the Atlantic too, and that is the Bermuda High, which we call the North Atlantic Subtropical High, but
right.
Commonly referred to, that tends to retreat to the northeast, and that tends to steer the storms more to sea.
And why are they calling it a super El Nino this year?
Yeah, all the models, all the precursors of the developing event, everything is pointing to a really big event. And so one of the key factors is what's happening below the surface in the tropical Pacific. And so we look at that as an indicator of what's coming. And that's really indicating for a very strong event on the order of magnitude that's very similar to the 1997-98 event.
Okay.
So really, all signs are pointing to a pretty strong event.
And on the other side of the spectrum, when it's a La Nina out there, that means that you have cooler water temperatures, but then that doesn't produce the effects that can help us, curtail hurricane activity on this side in the Atlantic.
That's right.
Okay.
So during the La Nina, you tend to get the opposite effect. It's important to also really make sure we're a little bit sober about this.
Sure.
What's happening in the Atlantic at the same time is really important. So if the Atlantic is really warm, that could overcome that wind shear effect.
Uh-huh. That's a good caveat. Yeah. And Jenny Stiletovich, I want to then go to another caveat that you've pointed out to me, which is last year we also had what the experts would call a relatively light hurricane season, volume-wise, and yet strength-wise, it was a different story, no?
Right. So last year we had only 13 named storms, but five major hurricanes. Three of those became Cat 5 storms, so the top storms. Yeah. And four of those major hurricanes rapidly intensified, and that's something that worries emergency managers because you have so little time. Well, and forecasters too, because you have so little time to prepare for those.
And did that rapid, we've been talking here about, you know, how things will be out in the Atlantic, but that rapid intensification, again, I'm just speaking as a layperson, but we tend to see it, that rapid intensification of storms more out in the Gulf, where the water temperatures, because of the enclosure of it, seem to be higher?
Well, so what can happen when the storm moves over pockets of warm water, and especially deep warm water, that's when they get a lot of fuel fast.
Yeah.
And so you'll see them in the Gulf because there's the loop current and it has eddies that spin off of it. And one of Ben's colleagues at University of Miami has studied those loop currents a lot and how you can use those to better predict rapid intensification. But yes, mm-hmm. it is just lots of hot water that's deep, and it's just supercharges.
So again, even though we may have a lower volume, what storms we do have, you know, could be a big problem.
Right. Last year we had Melissa hit Jamaica. It was one of the most intense hurricanes on record when it made landfall.
Ben Kirtman, that point Jenny makes about storm intensity these days being perhaps a bigger concern than storm quantity, that of course brings us to the question of how climate change and man-made global warming is creating a situation where even a smaller number of hurricanes, as we've just mentioned, can pack enough punch to make it feel like a heavy season. Can you go into that climate change facet of things for us?
Yeah, so one of the strongest signals we have in the hurricane field in climate change is there's the total number of storms, the frequency of storms, that tends to remain about the same. What we're seeing is a shift from, say, you know, category 1, 2, and 3 storms to more 4 and 5 storms. So there's, when we look at the climate going forward, we're going to expect more major hurricanes. The reason for that is that we're providing a lot more fuel for these storms. So once they get going, it's much easier for them to intensify. That fuel is that warm water in the Atlantic. And so mm-hmm. if you look at the surface temperatures of the ocean in the Atlantic going forward, we've been, you know, warmer than normal for over a decade.
Yeah.
And that is going to continue to persist.
Again, really, really good caveat. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with WLRN's Jenny Stiletovich and the University of Miami's Ben Kirtman about the lighter hurricane season we're told to expect this year and where things stand with all those federal forecasters who've been laid off recently. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Jenny Stiletovich, let's pivot to that situation with forecasters. Last year, Congress rejected the Trump administration's proposed $1.5 billion reduction in the $6 billion budget of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, which oversees the National Hurricane Center here in Miami, for example. But the administration still scaled back a good chunk of funding. What impact did that have, especially personnel-wise, in terms of the reduction of storm forecasters?
So just to point out, the National Hurricane Center forecasting, no forecasters were cut from the National Hurricane Center. It's on the research side of it, and mm-hmm. those are the folks that provide information, help build the models, and help build the tools for better forecasting. Mm-hmm. What got a lot of attention was the cuts to the National Weather Service, and the service, between layoffs and retirements, lost 600 people. Mm-hmm. That's important because when a hurricane comes ashore, comes into an area, the hazard forecasting shifts from the Hurricane Center to the local National Weather Service office. So they're mm-hmm. the ones that are working with emergency managers and putting out alerts to the public. And if those offices are understaffed, that's a problem. They like to have coverage, you know, round the clock. There were some offices that were falling below the number.
But that's still really important because, in my understanding, the development of these more modern models is one of the biggest, you know, things we've had to celebrate about, you know, hurricane preparation over the past decade, no?
Yeah, yeah. They did, right when I started covering hurricanes in 2014, they were doing a 10-year hurricane improvement forecast project, and largely succeeded. The forecast prediction is way better. They're improving on rapid intensification. That is an area that they're really hyper focused on, and they are making improvements on that. But you need all that, and Ben can talk about this more. Sure. That hurricane research is really what will continue for that to improve.
And just quickly, where do things stand now then? Is the administration still pursuing these kinds of cuts?
In the proposed budget, they again are proposing cuts to NOAA research, but they have gone on a hiring spree to replace the forecasters in the National Weather Service. Uh-huh. But those are entry-level meteorologists. They had about 500 retire. They're replacing them with 450 entry-level meteorologists. So it's a lot of expertise and
institutional knowledge.
Exactly.
Yeah. Ben Kirtman, you've also been director of the NOAA-related Cooperative Institute for Marine and Atmospheric Science, or CMAS. It trains many hurricane researchers. There's also the Atlantic Oceanographic and Meteorological Lab, based on Virginia Key here, and the National Center for Atmospheric Research, based out in Colorado. All these, too, have been affected by the cuts, but the University of Miami has been able to incorporate some, if not a lot, of these people into the Rosenstiel School. Can you tell us more about that, please?
Yeah, so when there was the effort to reduce the federal workforce, there was a recognition by Congress primarily that the mission has not changed. And so in order to meet that mission, NOAA then decided that they had to put more money into this Cooperative Institute program, into CMAS, in order to keep that expertise. And I think that's really important. So the University of Miami stepped up and we hired some of these folks. That expertise takes a decade to build.
Yeah.
So you're talking about, you know, training someone as a PhD scientist and getting a postdoc and then gaining experience. That's a decade-long process. And so we really didn't want to lose that momentum, those people. So we tried to pick up as many as we could in collaboration with our NOAA partners.
And then where would you feel things stand then now with the retaining of that expertise? Do you feel good about that as we approach this new season?
There's parts of it that I do feel good about it. I think the mission will be met. But just in terms of the overall health of the laboratories that we primarily collaborate with, I think the rebalance of the federal workforce versus the folks that are at the University of Miami, that should be a 50-50 proposition. Mm-hmm. And right now it isn't. It's more University of Miami than it is the federal workforce. So I think a little more balancing back would be better for the for both institutions.
So Jenny Stolodovich, finally, even hurricane forecasting can't escape AI, artificial intelligence. And you mentioned to me that AI tools are now surfacing in this business. Do they look promising or not?
Well, yes. So last year, people have talked about this. The Google-driven AI forecasting model did really well. However, I will say that earlier this month, Michael Brennan, the director of the National Hurricane Center, pointed out that during Melissa, the forecasters at the Hurricane Center outperformed the AI model.
Okay.
So
the human factor is still there. Good.
Yes.
Always good to know. Jenny Stolodovich is WLRN's environment editor. Ben Kirtman is dean of the University of Miami's Rosenstiel School of Marine, Atmospheric, and Earth Science. Many thanks to you both. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And if you want to explore these issues further, watch WLRN's new TV documentary, Facing the Future, South Florida versus Climate Change, on WLRN's YouTube channel. Still to come, South Florida Muslims celebrate Eid al-Adha, which has a lot in common with Christianity and Judaism. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. Most non-Muslims are familiar with the Islamic observance of Ramadan. But this week, Muslims are celebrating Eid al-Adha, as this takbir chant announces.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, La ilaha
Eid al-Adha is actually the most important Muslim festival because it commemorates Islam's core tenet, submission to God or Allah. We point that out today as part of an ongoing effort we've started to highlight the multitude of religions, not one faith, but the multitude of humane belief systems that make up the tapestry that America's founding fathers envisioned, including atheism. Last month, we took advantage of Passover and Easter falling at the same time to invite Jews and Christians to explain the rich differences and similarities between their two faiths. Now, as Eid al-Adha draws to a close this weekend, we want to highlight Islam, the world's second largest religion with as many as 200,000 followers in South Florida, and discuss the challenges it's facing in the U.S. today. Dr. Tarek Chebbi is the imam or congregation leader of the Al-Ihsan Masjid or Mosque in South Miami-Dade. This week, I spoke with Imam Chebbi, who is also a respected education scholar here. Dr. Chebbi, or Tarek, because you and I have known each other a long time, thank you for talking with us.
It is my pleasure, Tim.
And Eid Mubarak.
Really appreciate it.
Let's start with that greeting I just said, which means have a blessed or happy Eid. Remind us what in Arabic is an Eid, spelled E-I-D, and what then is the meaning of Eid al-Adha, which Muslims have been celebrating since Tuesday evening and ends Saturday?
Well, Eid means festival. And in Islam, we have 2 days of Eid. The Eid that follows the end of Ramadan, the month of fasting, and then Eid al-Adha, which is this one that we celebrated this week and coincides with the Hajj or pilgrimage to Mecca.
Right. And I want to get to that. But Adha itself means sacrifice.
Sacrifice.
Right. Okay.
Adha means sacrifice.
Right. And we're going to get to why that matters. And I know this Eid is famous for grilling meat, Tarek, especially lamb and goat. What did you make this week?
Lamb.
Lamb. Okay. So it's the sacrifice that Eid al-Adha refers to specifically is the story of Abraham being willing to sacrifice his son on God's orders. So I think it's important to point out here that the most important festival of the Islamic faith is based on a famous story in the Jewish and Christian Bible, in the book of Genesis, actually. Most non-Muslims would assume that the most important Muslim holiday involves the religion's founder, the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. But why instead, Tarek, does it involve the biblical story of Abraham's or Ibrahim's willingness to sacrifice his son Isaac, or Ishmael, as he's called in the version of the Muslim holy book, the Quran?
That's exactly correct, Tim. This event represents the essence of Islam itself, which is obedience, trust, sacrifice, gratitude, and submission to the will of God that we, as Muslim, we call Allah. To give you a little context from the Islamic point of view, Abraham did not have a child, and he kept doing supplication to Allah for a child. And we believe that Abraham was given that child, Ismail, from Hajar, peace be upon her, when he was about 86 years of age. So remember, all these years, he's wishing for a child.
Yeah.
And then he gets the child. But the Quran says, and when Ismail reached the age of working with Abraham, Abraham said, oh, my son, I see in my dream that I sacrifice you. Ismail, his answer was astonishing. He said, oh, father, do what you've been ordered to do, and you will find me by the will of Allah among the patients. In Islam also, we believe that dreams of prophets are not dreams, but are revelation from God.
And of course, in the Bible and in the Quran, at the last minute, God prevents Abraham from sacrificing his son.
That is correct. And also that's documented in the Quran when God says that this is indeed a great, really difficult trial. Oh, Abraham, you have passed the test,
right,
and therefore we will reward you.
Why, though, Tarek, is the sacred pilgrimage to Mecca, known as the Hajj, as you mentioned before, which I know you've made many times, why is that so central to Eid al-Adha as well? And please explain to people why the Kaaba, that massive granite shrine in the middle of Mecca, is so central too.
Eid al-Adha coincides with the season of pilgrimage. And one important pillar of the pilgrimage is the, probably you've seen it then on TV, what's called the stoning, that Muslims, they go and they stone symbolically Satan. Where does this come from? We believe that when Abraham was given this order and he was going with his son Ismail to sacrifice him, Satan appeared three times as a pious man, and he was basically making Abraham feel bad. He put some doubt in Abraham, but Abraham said no. And this is also in the Islamic faith, that the Satan is very, very determined to push people to disobey Allah.
And that is why the Hajj is so important, the pilgrimage is so important to go to take part in that ritual.
Exactly. Stoning symbolically Satan.
Right. At that large stone building called the Kaaba in Mecca.
Right.
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 Now, the name Islam itself means submission. Tell us how in Islam do Muslims believe that tenet, that message of submission, was handed by Allah to Muhammad, the prophet, peace be upon him, when the religion was founded in 610 CE or AD?
Islam is a continuation of the previous religion of Judaism and Christianity. And how this revelation came to Muhammad, it was in a cave that was actually outside Mecca called the Cave of Hira. And when Muhammad was looking and for, you know, guidance, and he used to seclude himself in this cave, and he, the first thing that he received was Iqra, which means read.
That's what became the Quran.
Exactly.
Right.
And then it was revealed through angel Jibreel, Gabriel.
Gabriel, right. Now, how did that idea of submission then inform what are known as the five pillars of Islam, like zakat, the sacred obligation to give to people in need?
Right. The five pillars of Islam in order. One is to believe in the oneness of God, that there is only one God to be worshipped. The second pillar is to perform the daily prayer, that is five prayers a day.
Right.
Third, you fast the month of Ramadan for those who are able, who are physically able, you know. Fourth is to give charity. And charity is very, very important in Islam. It is required by our religion at about 2.5% of your wealth that you have not used for the year to give to the poor. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot of emphasis on the social support and help. And again, these for people who are able and have the financial means. And the fifth one is the pilgrimage or Hajj for those who can, and you're required to do it once in a lifetime. There's another thing is pillars of faith. You believe in Allah, in the hereafter, in destiny, good and bad. You believe in the angels. You believe in all books that were revealed before, so the Bible, the Torah, and of course the Quran. And you believe in the other prophets that came before Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam.
So let's look further into that reality that Islam, Judaism, and Christianity make up what we call the Abrahamic faiths, because all three claim Abraham as their origin. The Quran also recognizes Jesus as a sacred prophet of God, and it reveres his mother, Mary. Is it sometimes frustrating, Tariq, that most Jews and Christians don't know that about Islam?
Tim, yes, you're right. And everything I'll give you here is documented in the Quran. In the Quran, Moses, alayhi salam, or peace be upon him, is mentioned 136 times. With regard to Jesus and Mary, Allah in the Quran says to Mary, and indeed Allah has chosen you, purified you. And we believe that Jesus was born as a miracle event.
As the Virgin Mary, as we call her
as
in Christianity,
Mary.
Right.
Yeah. In the Quran, it says, indeed the example of Jesus to God is like that of Adam. He created him from dust, and then he said to him, be, and he was.
That's a fascinating Muslim interpretation of Christianity. Thanks for that. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Imam Tariq Chebbi of the Alisan Masjid, or Mosque, in South Miami-Dade, about the Islamic holy festival of Eid al-Adha that Muslims are celebrating now, and the Islamophobia and other challenges Muslims here and around the U.S. face today. Tarek, as I mentioned, there are estimated to be as many as 200,000 Muslims in South Florida today. That's one of the largest communities in the country. Why does Islam have such a strong following here? And what would you say are some of the most important contributions Muslims make here?
I think we find, as Muslims, the South Florida community is very welcoming, and really we interact with so many non-Muslims, and it's just a wonderful community. And Muslims in America in general and in South Florida are citizens, professionals, educators, business owners, doctor in the army, and neighbors and community members. For example, Project Downtown Miami, started by Muslim youth, and it's been going on for several years. My own kids participated in feeding and serving homeless individuals in downtown Miami.
Which refers to that Muslim obligation of zakat.
Exactly.
But Muslim communities like South Florida's today are often facing a more hostile environment, as are other U.S. religious minorities like Jews. The tragedy this month in San Diego, where two white Christian nationalist youths killed three people at a mosque, is just the latest instance. How are Muslim congregations like yours confronting the rise in Islamophobia in the U.S., and what do you attribute it to? I know, for example, we hear a lot more false rhetoric these days about Muslims wanting to impose Sharia law on America.
The challenges are there. And as a Muslim community, we deal in with Islamophobia from an Islamic point of view, which is we believe that this is a test, and we accept that test. However, I think it's misinformation. And then even the term Sharia law, for those who talk, you know, you ask them what is Sharia law, I don't think they will be able to explain this. Even you ask me myself, what is Sharia law? Sharia law, it's in the home level, you know, not to impose anything on another.
On government, for example.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. At the time of the Prophet, you know, Muhammad, peace upon him, in Medina, when it was all the non-Muslim, they had their own laws. It was not imposed on them. And they were in a Muslim, you know, if you would, by nowadays terms, is a Muslim country. There's a freedom. There's a big, an important concept in Islam is la ikraha fi din, means there is no coercion in Islam, and every a human being is, you know, free will, and you don't impose your laws on others.
That leads me to the last thing I wanted to ask you, Tarek, how you think Muslims feel about the growing wave on the political right to declare the U.S. an exclusively Christian nation. Does that seem a bit hypocritical, since Americans criticize retro-Muslim theocracies like Iran's, especially places where Christians and other non-Muslims are often persecuted? And for that matter, didn't famous Muslim thinkers like Ibn Rushd promote religious tolerance?
Absolutely right. Absolutely. Even nowadays, we have in many Muslim countries now where you have Christian who are practicing Christianity, and like, for example, a place like Tunis, where in the capital, in the center, in the most important...
Right, in the country of Tunisia, where you are originally from.
Yes, there's big church right there, and people are practicing freely. There's also two cities known as La Goulette and Djerba, where Jewish are, you know, free, and they have their own, they practice with a lot of freedom, and then people can check this. And the example, not just in Tunisia, but in many others, where they, even though they are in Muslim country, they have freedom, complete freedom to practice their religion.
All right.
And I want to finish with one verse from the Quran, and that people probably, you know, this is really our guidance on how to interact with other human beings, you know, whether they're of the Abrahamic religion or atheist, any human being. Allah said in the Quran, chapter 49, verse 13, O mankind, we created you from a male and female, and this is referencing Adam and Eve. And we made you into nations and to tribes. For what purpose? So that you may know one another. That is the model or the principle that all Muslims should go by.
Tarek, Dr. Chebbi, many thanks. And again, Eid Mubarak.
Thank you very much, Tim. It was a pleasure.
That was my conversation this week with Tarek Chebbi, Imam of the Ali San Masjid, or Mosque, in South Miami-Dade, during the Muslim holiday of Eid al-Adha. That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. The show is produced by Katie Munoz and Denise Royal. Denise is the senior producer of content streaming and news products. Katie is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is WLRN's digital director. Sergio Bustos is our vice president of news. The vice president of radio and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mears. MJ Smith engineered today's show. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.